It's been 10 years. I've been talking to you guys off and on, and it's already a decade. So obviously, this is something that's going to last. Take us back to the beginning. How did this start? How did the two of you meet? And why are you doing what you're doing?
We met on the slam poetry circuit in Kalamazoo.
Gabriel and I were actually competitors. Yep. At the time. And he thought he was better than me.
And I was.
Yeah, well, he won. But, I was brand new to it. I was a teacher at Portage Northern High School at the time. And
Teaching English?
I was an English teacher, yeah. I taught International Baccalaureate, which was the advanced track, as well as mid-tracks and what I call my auto-tech English classes as well. So they were the struggling to learn, so to speak. Taught them all. And I advocated for all those students to share their voice, and especially to do it through spoken word. And then I got called out one time about, hey, you know, Mr. Latimer, you know, you tell us to do this. Do you share your own voice? And the truth of it was is that I was a hypocrite, and I didn't. So I wrote this poem, this piece, ended up going and accidentally ended up competing to make the national team totally by accident. I had no idea what I was getting into, and that's when I met Gabriel.
Yeah, that year the Poetry Slam had moved from what was then Craft Brow, which is now Top Dog.
Old Dog.
At that point,
it's the Top
poetry,
Dog.
The Poetry Slam had moved from Craft Brow, which is now Old Dog. I was going to say it again. Moved from Old Dog to the Stagecoach Barn in Richland.
Behind the Black Hawk Bar and Grill, right?
And then became Black. Yeah, it's changed names a bunch of times.
Jeez, Pete.
Anyway.
See, we're seeing our 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, it moved from Kalamazoo to Richland.
Yeah.
And because of that, there was a loss of a few competitors. And so Tracy Smith, the host at the time, did basically a open call. So you didn't have to qualify to try out for the national team like you normally do for the first round.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody could come out and compete, and if they landed in the top five after the first round, they could stay in the competition. So after round one, I was in first place and Kirk was in second place.
Oh, so you were better.
And so that's how we ended up meeting. I can't say we really gelled or jived, you know, when we first met. I mean, we always joke that we didn't like each other, but, you know, in competition, you're kind of going head to head, but
it's an exaggeration that we like to call on, you know,
but you know, we were competing against each other. So obviously I wanted to win. He wanted to win.
Sure.
We ended up, solidifying each one of the five slots to represent Kalamazoo at Nationals. And we ended up working together. And slam is one of those interesting birds where it's when you get to the national scene, it's very, in my opinion, there are great people there, but it's very ego driven.
It seems a little bit more like a popularity contest to me.
If you've been in it long, you know, the one poem that's going to get you really high scores. It's all about, you know, crowd participation versus really crafting an amazing piece. You learn what the crowd's going to cheer for and how to get those scores.
And there's an art form in that, too.
Absolutely.
Not to take it away from them.
No.
That wasn't our focus.
Yes. Yeah. So I did something very different, and I took the best piece that I got individual scores on.
Yeah.
And I offered it up as a duo to Kirk so that we would perform it together, because Kirk's energy is extremely high. He's a very kind of bombastic performer in a good way, you know.
And most of the time in a good way.
I found it to be a skill set that I admired, that I didn't really utilize as a performer. I'm a little bit more introverted.
Reserved, possibly.
And so together, this piece took on a new dynamic.
You kind of balance each
Correct.
Other.
That's right.
Yeah. And so through that experience, we started gelling. Kirk's high energy and academic writing background mixed with my more kind of inviting and hip-hop background, and we developed a new style. If you listen to slam poetry even today, there's a similarity in the cadence, delivery, that over time, like I said, because you see what wins, people take on.
Sure.
You know? And so we didn't do that.
Yeah.
And even today, now, if we were to compete in slam, we'd get slaughtered because our style is so different.
It isn't slam anymore,
correct.
What we do. Yeah.
And so we went to Nationals. It was a really cool learning experience, but we kind of felt like, you know what? Why are we competing to have 3 minutes on stage to preach to the choir?
And let me toot our own horn for a moment, because when we were there competing, I mean, we got acknowledgement for being a duo.
We did. We got special showcases.
We got really great high scores.
Yeah.
But in the long run, I remember when we came back, we were like, let's kill the next competition. So we started practicing ahead of time, and we knew the two of us could just kill the scene. And in the middle of it, we were like, why are we doing this for, you know, the little bit of time on stage when we could do something that was a bit more meaningful to us?
And we knew we had something. Mm-hmm. We could both feel it. And so we created the name. This was in 2006, so this was 11 years ago. And then in 2007, we formulated our name, Kinetic Effect.
Yeah, and we were thinking of Kinetic Karma.
Well, I came to the table with Kinetic Karma. I have a little bit more of an Eastern philosophy upbringing,
remember the first time I saw that name, I thought, do these guys know how to spell?
Well, that's right.
So here's the thing, not to get into a long conversation about it. It was literally a 2-hour endeavor to figure out the second word.
Mm-hmm.
And originally it was effect affect. So we had Kinetic Effect. Our logo was Kinetic Effect, and underneath it we had a reflection where the word was upside down.
Ah.
And it was affect.
Okay.
And then over time we were like, let's simplify.
Yeah.
And affect being more of the emotional, you know, cause driven. So,
right.
Yeah, I love when people are like, that's not grammatically correct. And I'm like, I'm a poet. I get to decide what's grammatically correct for this.
You get to invent your own words if you want to.
So we formed that in 2007. We put on our first show that summer, and we got such great response, especially in Kalamazoo, which is a very art and philanthropic, you know, supportive community. We were surprised by how much positive feedback and encouragement we got. Then we went from there. A year later, Kirk took a sabbatical. I graduated from Western, I had an opportunity to go to Columbia College in Chicago to get my master's degree, decided to not do that.
Yeah.
And we agreed to try it for 5 years.
Through
thick and thin.
So that was a plan, 5 year.
Yes.
5 year plan. Okay.
And in four, it was struggle. I mean, there was a lot of struggle.
It's
in the beginning.
Understatement.
And by year four,
well, how did
we
you
knew.
Start thinking, like, how are we going to make a living off of this?
We didn't
this?
Know. We had no idea.
Okay.
We just, for whatever reason,
follow
knew,
your bliss.
I felt like it would be okay. And then within the first couple of years, I felt like it wouldn't be okay. I was not making any money. Could not barely afford anything. I had to, you know, beg, borrow, and steal. And I remember in particular, I received a letter from the superintendent of the school system I came from that personally requested for my return. We miss you.
Yeah.
And they were actually going to offer a little bit
year.
Of incentive.
Yep.
Incentive for me to come back.
So this was your test.
And I called Gabriel.
Yep.
And I was in tears because I was ready to just kind of give up.
Yeah.
And he was also going through a divorce at the time. So there was a lot. Mm-hmm. And a transition.
There was a lot going on.
Sensitive point in your life.
He had just had a child.
Yes.
There was a ton.
So money.
And I was
money
poor.
Matters.
Yeah. And you got a child and you can't even buy him a toy, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
So I remember calling Gabriel and I was like, Gabe, what do I do? And he goes, I know you probably don't want to hear this, but he said, just give it one more year.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, no. And then I did. And within that 1 year, we made a living, finally.
So,
and I love
Gabe,
that he can admit that I was right.
So, Gabe, what gave you the confidence? I mean, hey, you're telling your friend that you may not be able to feed your kid, but give it one more year. What gave you the confidence to say that, put that on your shoulders?
It's hard to say definitively. You know, it's kind of like when you meet that person that you just know. You know, I knew that, first of all, I saw Kirk in a classroom setting for, you know, almost full 2 years before, right? So 2006 when we were competing in 2007 all the way through the summer into 2008 before he left before the fall of 2008. I knew what kind of a worker he was. This was a guy who got into the classroom at, you know, 6 a.m., was there until long after all the other teachers were gone.
Yeah.
This was a man who was dedicated, who connected with students, who sat through his lunch period with them. I mean,
yeah.
There was very little selfishness within him. He was a giver and a hard worker. And so I could see, and I knew in my mind, if that ability to take all that drive and focus was shifted onto what we were doing, there was no way I was going to fail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And I had that same drive,
yeah.
You know, and
I passion. Need someone who could handle me because,
yeah.
You know, I'm sure a couple people would say I'm a handful sometimes, you know, I am a hard worker. There are things that I do that I know are positive, but they come from a space of sometimes a lot of deep negativity from my background. Mm. And so it was interesting for me because I don't really have friends and I don't really keep people close to me, even as a person today. And Gabriel,
got
for whatever
that wall
reason,
around
yes,
it. Yeah, yeah.
But Gabriel has this ability to just kind of say, "I don't really care about your wall, and I'm going to get in there anyway."
Yeah,
and that tells me he's loyal, and that no matter what, he's going to be there when everything hits the fan and everything's breaking down. I know that I can rely on that person, and I'm telling you what, that means a lot to me. And I know that I can explode at times and have issues, but it's like when you're in that really great relationship with someone, they understand you and can always move past it at some point. And I think that's been extremely valuable for me, and that's what enabled me to kind of stick with it, even though occasionally, you know, we have had bumps.
Yeah,
you know,
we're like brothers. You know, we get into our arguments and stuff, and
yeah.
And so I think given all that, I knew if we don't give up on this, something has to give. There has to be, you know, and we were on America's Got Talent, you know, that year.
That was cool.
And even though we didn't win, it, you know, within the first year of us doing this and we were looking at going out to perform at Amateur Night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem and all these things were popping up. We kept getting such positive feedback from people. I knew we had something. It was just a matter of figuring out how to be malleable enough.
So in that 1 year, what clicked? What happened that put you finally over that edge?
Well, I wouldn't say it was just the 1 year. I would say it took us into year three to really really see the results. From everything that I've read in business books and just kind of in life in general, there seems to be a common theme around having to put in the hard work before you're able to reap the benefits around 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be just as, you know, not that it doesn't happen before or after.
I've heard that about business in general.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever
that's
the business
right.
is.
So my
yeah.
focus mm-hmm. was really on that from the jump, which was, you know, if we put the effort in and
yeah.
plant enough seeds, eventually things are going to grow.
Okay.
I think what happened was, you know, and we kind of talk about this a lot, is, you know, people develop a very sharp focus of, I'm at A, I want to get to B, here are the steps on how I do that. And I think that's great for a lot of straightforward businesses.
Yeah.
But we're not making widgets, right? We're speakers, we're poets. We weren't doing motivational speaking at the time. We were strictly doing, performance art. And so what we always joke around with is most people have a target. You know, let's use the bow and arrow metaphor. They pull back on their bow and they shoot their arrow into the target.
Mm-hmm.
If it lands close to the center, you know, they know that they're getting closer.
They make an assessment based on that.
Mm-hmm. What we did was we just kind of pulled back on our bow and arrow, shot the arrow into the woods, and wherever it stuck into a tree, we just painted the target around it. So we learned that when things come up, you have to be able to be malleable.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be willing
sure.
to move
yeah.
and shift, you know, in an instant. I mean, you think about, like, these conglomerates, you know, like Blockbuster Video
mm-hmm.
that Netflix destroyed, right? Because they weren't willing to move with the times.
Yeah, yeah.
We've always been able to move and shift when things were presented to us so long as we stayed true to who we were.
Yeah, because we mm-hmm. maintained our own integrity.
Correct.
Actually, we grew our integrity
yeah.
over time.
So I think the things that really took off was in 2009, we started our nonprofit. That was important to both of us to be able to reach out to youth. We were total knucklehead troublemakers. In trouble with the law. Both of us are best friends. Both of our best friends from high school went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to give back. You know, we have residency program. This is our eighth year, actually, that we've been at Lakeside
yeah,
Academy.
If I'm understanding your journey correctly, you start with poetry, spoken poetry. But at what point does it turn into motivational, helping
that's
the kids?
That's a good question.
Or did it just kind of happen?
And that's
okay.
I mean, in the beginning, we used to do like in an hour, 11 poems in a presentation, and now we do three, and the rest of it is us speaking extemporaneously.
So,
you know, off the top.
What happened was Kirk is very good at being able to be off the cuff, just in the moment, go with the flow. I like a little bit more structure to know, you know, where we're going. I'm cool with going off the plan, but I want a plan.
Sometimes I can go way off the plan.
So in our theater shows, when we were doing 2 hour, 15 poem, full on lights, theater, music, blocking, everything, Kirk would just randomly take off from the stuff that we'd been practicing for 3 months and go off on these tangents.
You do need a leash.
Which would totally throw me off.
But it would grab that audience.
But it was good because over time I learned to relax around being comfortable with that, right? So moved to, people started asking us to come out and perform, and we would be on stage and Kirk would go off in these tangents, and I started to see, okay, well, we need to get back to where we're going.
Yeah.
So I would kind of be that he would go off over here and I would have to connect to wherever he was and bring it back.
Okay.
And over time we started to develop this rapport where we could speak without speaking to each other on how to get and weave back and forth in between the poems. The more
that happened, finish each other's sentences as your relationship.
Correct.
That's
really,
right.
So the more time that happened, the less time we had for poems, which also meant in the middle of a set, I would have to decide we don't have time to do this piece or that piece. And I would have to let Kirk know without telling the audience.
Right.
So over time, it went from 11 to 10 to 7 to 5 and now 3. So it really was just, there wasn't a moment where we were like, let's do less talking and or more talking and less poems. It was just, we just went with where
the
audience took us.
Speak it forward and how that connects with kinetic affect.
Yeah, well, kinetic affect is our band name, okay, for lack of a better phrase. But when we gained enough notoriety and understanding that our work can also provide an educational component, which is very much my, you know, my neck of the woods, we decided to create Speak It Forward, which is our 501c3 educational and charitable nonprofit organization. And it is really dedicated to helping other people tell their stories. Because while it is great to be able to use our stories as a model for other people, you know, to see how, you know, we can be vulnerable and there's strength in that, I think it's even more powerful when you get other people to tell theirs.
So we use spoken word poetry as a Trojan horse to engage youth where they're at, to increase self-awareness, self-confidence, verbal skills, literacy skills. And the cool part is we knew that what we were doing was valuable.
Yeah.
Now more and more studies are coming out that are showing not only is it valuable, but disclosure of self in a safe environment helps change your personal identity, can help rearrange your social identity, or in other words, how you fit into a community. So take a juvenile who's always been told they're bad, who's always been told that they're bad for this thing that they did, help them structure their story in a way that can be heard by someone who has a completely opposite upbringing in life, be able to get them on the stage to be able to do that presentation. We connect across worlds, and that juvenile receives a standing ovation from several hundred people in an audience, and all
stuff.
Of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, I can talk about this, receive love, I don't have to necessarily feel as bad. I can let go of some of this baggage I'm carrying, and now I can start to take the first steps towards.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the whole concept of therapy.
It is exactly that.
When you go and sit down with a counselor, that's you tell your story.
It is.
And just in the telling, there can be. But yeah, you're right. You've added on that extra element of telling it to the world.
Correct.
Yeah, that,
and then
the
being embraced.
The testifying is powerful because what that does, it almost solidifies a change in the narrative. Not only am I writing this down and I'm feeling it inside, but everyone is validating this for me. And not only that, it's not just important to change those that are stepping on stage. As a matter of fact, I don't think the work that we do when we present to the public is really necessarily for the troubled youth that are on stage. I think it's for the community. You know, yes. I had a great experience when I taught special education. I was part of a room and a group of young people who were totally immobile, yeah. Had, you know, mentalities of six-month-old children, even though they were 21, you know. And then we would go out and do what was called community experience. I was young at the time, and I remember talking to the teacher, the main teacher in the room, and saying, how is this community experience? They're not getting any experience. We're wheeling them around, and they're, you know, we're feeding them their food. What experience are they getting?
Yeah.
And she said, Kirk, first of all, they are getting some experience, but she said community experience is not for them. It's to educate the community on these individuals, to develop compassion and understanding.
Yeah.
How powerful was that? That when you can think of yourself as a teacher of the greater community. Yeah. So when we have these, you know, juvenile delinquents or whoever stepping on stage,
yeah.
ultimately they're helping the community understand who they are and humanize them.
Yeah, that's very important what you're saying, because you hear that, you know, strong on crime and
yep.
lock them up and throw
yes.
away the key. But I've sat in on your performances, and that is powerful yep. stuff when these kids go up there and, you know, read a poem that they've put together or say a poem that they've written about abuse or whatever they've mm-hmm. experienced in their lives. You can't walk out of there without several tissues being used up. It is powerful.
And we try and educate them, too. I mean, yeah. I understand that there needs to be some level of discipline for people who are committing crimes, right?
Right.
I think most people can agree with that. The problem is it's a growing business.
Yes.
You build a prison, you got to fill it. In order to fill it,
yeah,
you got to be
those private prisons
correct.
Worry me.
So that's one of, you know, that's one of the things that we want to continue to educate is, yeah, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. They need some help if they're, you know, committing crimes, but they need help. We don't need to help a private business grow its prison. We need to help those people because when they come back
exactly.
out, they're coming back out into our community.
Sure. These are your neighbors.
Exactly.
These are the people that work with you.
That's
that
right.
Hang out with your kids.
As a matter of fact, they might be
Let's
your neighbors who haven't ever been put in
yeah,
prison.
Yeah.
Because the reality is a lot of people just haven't been caught. You know, I mean, it's a sad that some people are under the microscope more than others.
Are there some stories, and this is probably going to be a difficult question,
sure.
that, you know, Lakeside Academy or the Kalamazoo County Juvenile Home, some of these kids, have they some stories that still haunt you that you really saw a transformation?
Oh, yeah. For sure.
You know, it's we've been kind of talking in generals, but, you know, put a face on this for us.
I think one of our first semesters there was, you know, one of the more powerful ones because it was an understanding and an education for us as well. You know, we were excited to be there. We were excited to connect with these youth. So first of all, when we get in there, it's really about letting them know that we're here for them. We're meeting them at their level. We're not there to tell them they're bad. So we don't ask what their charges are, what they're in for. We get to know them as people, right?
Yeah.
As we gain their trust and they start talking about their stories, we learn more about their backgrounds and why they're there and things that they've gone through. Well, there was a young gentleman when we were first there. He was on the verge of...
The tiger? You talking about Tyrese?
Yeah.
Tiger? Yeah.
He was on the verge of leaving the facility and heading to prison. Because, you know, some of them are 17, nearing 18, and, you know, if they can't graduate the program, they're off to prison.
Yeah.
And we connected with him. Somehow we were able to kind of break through that barrier with him and through the sharing of our story and the presentation and the art. And he started opening up. And by the end of the semester, he was the campus executive, meaning he had the highest level position, because Lakeside is a peer-driven culture. He had the highest level position on campus.
Mm.
He was showcased in our very first show that we did.
We called it Voices from the Shadows, and it was at the old Whole Art Theater.
Yeah, down on the mall, not at the Epic Center. And, I mean, he broke down on stage, cried, got a standing ovation. He was excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, wow. Remember before he stepped on, he was actually kind of like, he looked angry.
Yeah.
Because he was terrified. And that's what happened.
That's what a lot of these young men, instead of showing fear, they show anger. It's their go-to. Yep.
Yes, and it was amazing because
response.
What did he do on stage?
Yeah.
He cried.
Yeah.
So that was beautiful
so,
to see.
Eventually he graduated from Lakeside, flash forward a couple years, and we stay in touch with some of them, you know, if they reach out on social media. Or,
I was going to ask about that.
And Kirk found out that he had moved back to Indiana and was having some trouble with family, and him and his brother were homeless. So Kirk is just one of those people that just is so giving and very thoughtful of others when you really are, when you're able to break through that wall. And Kirk drove down there, picked him up. One of our mentors gave him a couch to crash on, and we had him start coming into Lakeside to work with us as a mentor.
And then
Lakeside found out and offered him a job.
All right.
So here's someone who was, you know, in the treatment facility there, on the verge of heading to prison, ended up being able to kind of turn things around. And, I mean, he's since moved on and is doing well. But, you know, for us, it was just an example of being able to see something come full circle, you know? And it's not to say that he doesn't still have his struggles and
isn't
still learning. It's not like he's, you know, perfect or, you know. Shoot, me and Kirk still have.
Well, I was going to say, in telling the story, I mean, it's not like we're heroes,
no,
by any means. You know what I mean? We're just doing honestly what we feel compelled to do.
Well, it seems to me that, and he's probably effective in what he does, and you guys are effective in what you do, because it's much easier to listen and relate to someone who's kind of been there and done that.
Yes.
You know, if you just came in from some shiny place on top of the mountain with a silver spoon,
correct,
they're not going to listen to
correct
you.
Right.
And, you know, I imagine as a mentor to his peers or younger kids, that was a powerful message. It's like, oh, you did it, then maybe I can do it.
Yes. And I think that was one of the things. Yes, we do model that behavior and tell them that, you know, where we came from, we were able to turn it around. And as I mentioned, you know, both our friends were in prison. And it was really cool to see the new group of students react to Tyrese when he came in.
Yeah.
Because once they heard that he had been there, it was like all eyes were on him, and they were just hanging on his every word.
Gives them hope.
Exactly.
They loved him.
So it was really cool to see.
Yeah.
So we've done 10 years. What's coming up in the next 10?
Well, you know, we are changing and growing in many ways. For example, I have more white hairs in my beard. And so, you know, why is that even important to mention? Because the reality is that your audience and your purpose and your messaging begins to change to some degree. And in being fluid, I mean, you have to understand, when you step, if I have all gray hair and I step up in front of a high school,
they're not going to listen to you anymore?
They're not going to hear me the same way. Now, don't get me wrong.
No,
I could still be silly and still gain them, but it's going to be a lot harder. So what's happening now, I think, in the next 10 years, I mean, there's a lot going on. We have so many amazing things hidden underneath the woodwork that is just waiting to, like, explode. But in many ways, we're doing a lot of work with regards to racial equity, understanding identity a lot more, especially within our organization, Speak It Forward. But as far as Kinetic Effect, we're currently working with North Dakota and their prison system. Going to be working with four of their prisons, including Maximum Security, to not only work with the residents and workshop them, but also to train trainers in each prison to carry on our work.
Nice.
And then we will be consultants. So in many ways, we are adapting and changing and beginning to work a lot more professional development as well.
Yeah, and that came about from we were invited to come to Denver, Colorado, to take part in the Warden Exchange. So, you know, as we mentioned, there are some of these private prisons that are, you know, I have some concern about. However, we got invited to this thing called the Warden Exchange, which had some of the wardens from, like, the top prisons, like the ones that you hear the name of and you know that prison, even if you've never been to that state. And
Rikers or something.
Correct. That kind of stuff. And, and some of the other ones. And I don't want to get into names and all that kind
of
stuff. But, but the ones where you hear it and you go, oh, I've heard of that prison before. And the beautiful thing was, is they had ex-wardens in there, current wardens in there, all talking about the humanity and treatment of the people. Now, for us, it, you know, we can be a little bit skeptical in coming down, we weren't really sure why they wanted us there or what purpose we were supposed to be there for. We kind of did our, you know, our thing and kind of talked about, you know, our experience in the juvenile justice system. But it was really cool to hear that there were people who were in charge of these things trying to figure out how to be better, how to treat the prisoners with more humanity, how to do a better job of rehabilitation, you know, how to keep the prison safer, not only for the guards, but also for the prisoners themselves. A lot of things that I would never expect to hear in a room full of wardens,
being proud to be a prison was something.
Correct.
You know, understanding, like, how can you look at a prison as an educational institution?
Right. So things, you know, I wasn't hearing anything about the bottom line or how to fit more people in a cell or anything.
That's encouraging.
It was. It was really encouraging, even from how to almost now separate from that, how to redesign, you know, because one of the ex-wardens was talking about the fact that you have in a lot of the cells a sink toilet combo unit. Right? Because you have the toilet and the sink that are one unit so that you can fit more people and how inhumane that can be.
Wow.
He even gave an example and said, you know, how many of you would go into, if you're looking for a house, would you ever buy a house that had a toilet sink combined where every time you needed to wash your hands, you were reaching over the toilet? And how that, over time, mentally and psychologically impacts prisoners. I mean, you're...
Tells you you're not human
or
maybe not.
You're dehumanizing them, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we had did a presentation there, and we've had contact with several of the wardens since, but the one in North Dakota reached out first and said, we would really like you to come work with our prisoners. And so we're really excited about that, to be able to kind of start to expand that work. As Kirk mentioned, through a nonprofit, we're doing a lot more with racial equity and identity. And
and we have a really great artistic endeavor that we worked with a studio out of New York that has yet to be released. And
we've been working on it for over a year.
And it is going to be a powerful thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
so
watch for that.
Yeah. We can't say too much about it.
We have a non-disclosure agreement as of this moment.
So. I'll have to bring you back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you both. We could probably talk for hours here. It's just absolutely fascinating.
Well, as you notice, when you ask a question, you get a half an hour answer.
And keep doing what you're doing. We need you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.